that most of the people who read this text and participate in this exercise will live for many, many more years afterwards. But still, look at the second hand of the stopwatch, and follow it as it records the passing minutes, counting down the minutes of your life that remain to you as they slip away. Are you living the life that you want to live? Are you living a life that, at any given moment, you could look back upon with satisfaction if you suddenly realized that it was about to end? Are you living the sort of life that you would wish upon a human being? A life that is exciting and full, that is well spent every minute of it? If the answer is no, what can you do in the time that still remains to you, however long or short that may be, to make your life more like the one you would like to live? For we all do have only a limited amount of time granted to us in this world. We should use it with this in mind. If you find looking back upon your life that you have spent years living without any consideration of your mortality, this is really not unusual, for our social, cultural environment does not encourage us to think much about the limits that nature places on our lives. Death and aging are denied and hidden away as if they were shameful and embarrassing. The older members of our society are hidden away in retirement homes, like lepers in leper colonies. The billboards, magazine photos, and television commercials that meet our eyes at every turn show only images of healthy men and women in the prime of their life. Cemeteries, which once memorialized the dead and preserved a place for them in the thoughts of the living, are now forgotten in abandoned neighborhoods and overgrown with weeds. When a man dies, the rituals which one would have celebrated his life and brought the subject of human mortality to the thoughts of those who survived him are now often regarded as mere inconveniences. Death is impolite and embarrassing. It is considered bad etiquette. There is no time for it in today's busy world of corporate mergers and record-breaking conspicuous consumption. Our busy schedules and glossy magazines neither make allowance for it nor offer any explanation of how it might be relevant to our value system or our lives. And indeed, if we were to stop and ponder the subject, perhaps we would find that when we seriously consider the limits of our time on this planet, keeping up with television comedies and having a good resume seems less important than they did before. Our cultural silence about human mortality allows us to forget how much weight the individual moments of our lives carry, adding up as they do to our lives themselves. Thus we squander countless hours watching television or balancing checkbooks, hours that in retrospect we might have done better to have spent walking on the seashore with our loved ones, cooking gourmet meals for our children or friends, writing fiction, or hitchhiking across South America. The reality of our future death is not easy for any of us to come to terms with, but it is surely better that we consider this now than regret doing so when it is too late. Our denial of death has a deeper significance. Beyond its functions as a reaction to our fear of mortality and a selective blindness that helps preserve the status quo, it is a symptom of our ongoing struggle to escape from cycles of change in nature and establish an unnatural permanence in the world. Our mortality is frightening evidence that we do not have control over everything. Thus we are quick to ignore it, if we cannot do away with it altogether, a feat towards which our medical researchers are working at breakneck speed. It is worth questioning whether this would even be desirable. Since the dawn of Western civilization, men and women have hungered for domination not only of the world and each other, but also for domination of the seasons, of time itself. We speak of the eternal grandeur of our gods and empires, and we design our cities and corporations to exist into infinity. We build monuments, skyscrapers, which we intend to stand forever as testimony of our victory over the sands of time. But this victory can only come at a price, at this price, that though nothing passes away, nothing comes to be either, that the world we create is a static, standardized place that can hold no surprises for us anymore. We would do well to be wary of fulfilling our own darkest dreams by creating such a dystopia, a frozen world in which no one must fear death anymore, for everyone exists forever and no one lives for even an instant. Rimbaud's Deathbed Conversion, Fall, 1891. Arthur Rimbaud converted on his deathbed to Christianity, he once despised, setting a new precedent for living life to the fullest. Rimbaud was born as the second of four children to a farmer's daughter living in rural France. At the age of 16, he ran away to live homeless on the streets of Paris, writing poetry that was at once visionary and blasphemous. He made the acquaintance of the poet Verlaine, with whom he stayed until Verlaine's wife forced him to leave. Verlaine had fallen in love with him and continued to support him, despite the scandal their homosexual relationship caused. Rimbaud wreaked havoc throughout Paris, knocking the hats off priests in the street, verbally and physically assaulting the popular poets Verlaine introduced him to, and destroying Verlaine's marriage. The two ran away into the countryside together, then moved to London to live in abject poverty until Rimbaud, disgusted with Verlaine, who claimed he couldn't live without him, decided to leave. In desperation, Verlaine shot Rimbaud, wounding him in the wrist. The police came, and Verlaine was jailed for 2 years on charges not of assault, but sodomy. Meanwhile, Rimbaud escaped to his mother's farm, where he completed the body of poems that was to change poetry and writing itself forever. Then, at the age of 18, Rimbaud put down his pen and announced he was done with being a poet. He learned 4 more languages, German, Arabic, Russian, and Hindustani. He already knew French, English, and Latin, among others, and set off traveling. He crossed the Alps on foot, joined the Dutch colonial army, and deserted in the Indies. Joined a German circus touring Scandinavia, visited Egypt, and worked as a laborer in Cyprus. Throughout all these adventures, he was plagued by serious illness and health problems, but he never let them slow him down. At the age of 29, he became the first white man to journey to the Ogaden region of Ethiopia, and his report, published in the Proceedings of the Geographical Society, aroused interest in academic circles. Rimbaud soon moved to Ethiopia as a gunrunner, and became close with the people there, living with a native woman and befriending the Ethiopian king. He received a letter from a famous poetry magazine in France begging him to return to lead the new literary movement that had grown up around his writings, but he didn't even bother to answer it. He didn't return to Europe until he developed a tumor in his right knee, which forced him to travel borne on a stretcher the thousands of miles back to France. There his leg was amputated and he languished in the care of his Christian mother and sister until, at the edge of death, exhausted beyond the bounds of even his love of life and truth, he made confession to a priest before expiring at the age of 36. Rimbaud knew better than to save any of himself for the grave. He spent every resource he had in his world down to the last penny, burned money, health, friends, family, sanity as so much fuel for the fire. So when death came to take him away, he got nothing, not even a man with his pride or common sense intact. His life still stands as an example to us all. Thank you.
your neighbor's affliction. Suffer not your neighbor's paralysis, but extend your hand. Extend your hand, lest you vanish in the city and be but a trace, just a vanished ghost in your legacy. All the things you knew, science, mathematics, thought, severely weakened. Like irrigation systems in the tired veins forming from the Tigris and Euphrates. In the realm of peace, all the world revolved around a perfect circle. City of Baghdad, city of scholars, empirical, humble. Center of the world, city in ashes, city of Baghdad, city of Baghdad, a brace of aloof.
Shakana, shakana.
garden beneath her feet. The one you drill, pulling the blood of the earth, little droplets of oil for bracelets, little jewels, sapphires, or you make bracelets round your own world. We are whipping tears, rubies. We offer them to you. Oh, we are just your Arabian nightmare.
Thank you.
the sun down on my face. I'll reach for the future. I won't look back. I wanna be free and leave it all behind. And I long to see the sun. In your eyes.
полумраке пещеры каждый выступ скалы, каждый камень приобретает сходство то со зверем, то со сказочным персонажем.
Oh,
пещеры, каждый выступ скалы, каждый камень приобретает сходство то со зверем, то со сказочным персонажем.
Two days, 4 hours, 17 minutes and 12 seconds away. I actually believe from coming out of the EU, this is a pretty good machine, actually. The truth of the matter, Minister, is it not that if we reject this SI tonight, and I hope we do by a big margin, we will have come out in domestic law and we'll be in breach of an international treaty for about 2 weeks. Isn't that the truth? And that's why you need to get this SI through.
Minister, I simply do not share my honourable friend's understanding or view of the matter. His point of view, but I'm afraid I think in terms of the legal facts, he is not right. A large volume of EU exit legislation preparing the statute book for the moment EU law ceases to apply is due to enter into force automatically on exit day. Without this instrument being in place, there would be a clash in our domestic law whereby contradictory provisions would apply, both EU rules and the new UK rules simultaneously, and in some cases, new UK rules would replace EU rules prematurely. We estimate that tens of thousands of amendments to our domestic legislation will be made in the light of EU exit. These include changes which relate to the sharing of information, reporting requirements placed on businesses and public institutions, and the role of the European Commission in issuing licences and certificates. For example, let us take the amendments relating to the rights of lawyers to practice in the UK. If these regulations come into force on 29th of March, EU lawyers who are not registered European lawyers immediately before exit day are at risk of committing a criminal offence if they continue to provide particular legal services in the UK. Other examples include UK operators being unable to comply with EU emissions trading scheme and having to surrender their emissions allowances early, and the risk of firms stop trading to avoid legal breaches given their uncertainty about when new customs, excise and VAT regimes would kick in. There are examples from across the statute book, but what is clear is that without this instrument, there would be significant confusion and uncertainty for businesses and individuals on the 29th of March. As I have said, happy to give way to my honourable friend.
The Supreme Court has given certain rights to young women. All I did was use those rights to pray to my God.
To make sure that our reputation across the world for being a country that is reliable to deal with, and whose obligations and international law are the same as our domestic legislation.
Minister, he and I have always agreed we need to do this process properly, and that is what this SI is all about. Happy to give way to the Honourable Lady.
Thank you. The Supreme Court had ruled that a ban on women between the ages of 10 and 50 going inside was illegal.
Such that
Kanaka,
why we affectionately refer to the withdrawal deal as the Prime
there
Minister's
There are a lot of customs and superstitions that
is,
need to change
it has been
if we want
by
to progress in
other
India.
EU member states.
But lots of people
it is
believe
signed, it
that
is
if
not
you don't
going
follow
to be
these signs,
the
then
is
bad
done.
Things
There's only
will happen
one deal, and that is the Prime Minister's deal. An extension that we need tonight is simply to give us a very short extension, but we absolutely have to get behind this Brexit deal, get it through, get the implementation period, and move on. It's not going to be reopened by the other 27.
As I often find, I wholeheartedly agree with the Honourable Lady. It isn't the sole point of this SI, of course, because this SI allows for two specific scenarios.
Outside the temple walls, conservative religious groups erupted in protest. Violence left one person dead and dozens injured. Priests conducted so-called cleansing rituals at the site because women like Kanaka, of menstruating age, are considered impure.
We need to fight. You know, that was the famous Churchill's dialogue in the Second World War. So we feel
Rahul Eshwar is a charismatic and outspoken critic of the Supreme Court. He helped organise the protests. For him, the battle is personal. Generations of his family have been involved with the temple. His grandfather was once high priest at Sabarimala. Eshwar denies accusations that in defending the ban, he and others like him have stirred the hatred now directed at Kanakadurga.
We condemn the violence. We are partially responsible for it. We have owned it up and we apologize for that violence.
Nevertheless, he insists, it's devotees like him that have been wronged.
We were pained that our human rights were being taken away. Our right to pray were being taken away because it is a part of our human rights to believe in.
Bringing back to this house,
in the shadow of a general
not just
election,
international law, but law that is binding in our own law and binding
India's
on this parliament,
party,
is making and lawmaking that people voted against in the referendum.
Decision is an attack
I'd say to you, my rightful friend, I think he makes an important point, actually, and I think it's a point on which many of us could agree that this process reflects some of the issues that caused people to vote the way that they did. But I would also say to him,
after her mother-in-law accused her of shaming the family and beat her.
The police were at the house. I could see...
Those of us who were in the House on Friday were gravely misled by what was said.
Well, I'm very grateful to the Honourable Gentleman for his point of order. Obviously, I well remember the exchanges and I'm aware of the particular interaction to which the Honourable Gentleman is referring. The normal principle applies. Every member is responsible for the veracity of what he or she says in this chamber. If a member inadvertently errs, it is incumbent upon that member to correct the record. The Minister perfectly reasonably said that he hadn't seen what was said, but I mean, it's not beyond the wit and sagacity of the Honourable Member for Christchurch to arrange for a copy of the extract from the official report to wing its way to the dispatch box during the course of this consideration, and the Minister might then be in a particular further to respond to the Honourable Gentleman. Minister.
Do you beg the Minister's pardon? Point of order, Angela Eagle.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Could you advise me whether what members opposite are actually objecting to is the use of the royal prerogative? Logic, which allows us to sign up to international treaties using that power, and the logic of what they're actually arguing is that we should...
I simply say to the Right Honourable Lady, it's not for me to offer an exegesis. It's not for me to offer an exegesis of what individuals might think about our constitutional arrangements, including the use or otherwise of the royal prerogative. But the Right Honourable Lady has made her own force in her own way with some panache, and it will be studied on the record. Oh, very well. Point of order, Mr. Mark Francois.
Very quickly, Mr. Speaker, there are some people in this House who do want to get rid of Her Majesty, but they're not on this side, they're on theirs.
Yes, can we... I'm extraordinarily grateful, I'm sure, to the Right Honourable Gentleman, but I wonder if we now might return to the relatively narrow ambit of the statutory instrument. Minister Robin Walker.
Speaker, I shall be brief. I am acutely aware of the huge amount of work undertaken by members across this House to scrutinise the near 550 statutory instruments brought forward to prepare for exit and provide legal certainty. If this instrument were not to pass, that work would be undermined by the legal uncertainty created. If, on the other hand, we pass today's instrument, then the only thing that would change across all of those SIs is the moment at which they come into force, aligning with the time of our exit so that they work properly. I remain hopeful that this House will support the Prime Minister's deal and that we will leave the EU on the 22nd of May with a short technical extension to ensure we can pass the necessary implementing legislation. This instrument is, however, without prejudice to whether that is the case. I hope this House can therefore agree on the necessity of this instrument and approve it so that it can come into force and avoid serious confusion and uncertainty for businesses and individuals. Mr Speaker, I beg to move.
Order. The question is motion number 4 as on the order paper.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I rise on behalf of the opposition to support the motion. As the Minister has made clear, the statutory instrument before us is a necessary one and it should be entirely uncontroversial. As the House knows, in response to the Prime Minister's letter of the 20th of March to the President of the European Council, The Council agreed to an extension of the Article 50 process until the 22nd of May, provided the withdrawal agreement is approved by the House this week. The Council further agreed that if the withdrawal agreement is not approved this week, an extension until the 12th of April would take place to allow for the UK to, and I quote, indicate a way forward for their consideration, something that we hope the preceding debate and votes will contribute to. On the 22nd of March, the UK's permanent representative to the EU, Sir Tim Barrow, wrote to the President of the Council to confirm agreement of the proposed extension arrangement under Article 50, subsection 3 of the Treaty on European Union. As such, Mr. Speaker, the extension of the Article 50 process till at least 12th of April will now happen as a matter of international law, and as the Minister said, it is legally binding in international law. This statutory instrument merely aligns exit day, as it is defined for the purposes of the EU Withdrawal Act, to the new dates that have been agreed. And it is entirely correct that it comes after agreement on extension was reached between the two parties. Indeed, the EU Withdrawal Act itself makes clear that this sequencing, that is to say that any new agreement between the parties as to when the treaties cease to apply to the UK must precede any change to exit day for the purposes of the Act. And that is what is precisely is required by the legislation. That is because Section 20, subsection 4 of the Act provides that a Minister of the Crown may, by regulations, amend the definition of exit day to, and I quote, ensure that the day and time specified in the definition are the day and time that the treaties are to cease to apply to the United Kingdom. The operative word, Mr. Speaker, being are, not the day and time the Government would be hoping the EU Council would agree to. As such, logically, the Act makes clear that the Government could not propose a statutory instrument that would stipulate a date or dates for exit day different to the date on which, as was agreed at the time, the treaties would cease to apply. In short, the power to redefine exit day as set out in the 2018 Act passed by this House only last year only arises if the date has already been changed. Those who... Happy to give way.
Thank you, Mr. Does the Shadow Minister agree with me that it refers to a date? Therefore, wouldn't it be more logical for this statutory instrument to have the 12th of April down?
The Brexit process beyond Friday the 29th of March, either because presumably they're relaxed about leaving with a deal or positively willing to give way.
I'm grateful for the opposition's support. Isn't the bottom line that we are extending Article 50 via this SI tonight to avoid the damaging no-deal exit that my constituents in Winchester, and I'm sure his constituents, do not want to see? And this House has expressly said on several occasions now, and I predict will again this evening, it does not want to see.
Thank the Honourable Gentleman for that intervention. I agree with him to the extent that we have to do everything possible to avoid a disastrous no-deal exit. This SI does not do that. The extension agreed by the Council and the UK does that. This SI ensures that our domestic legislation aligns with what's already been agreed and doesn't create legal confusion. It's certainly the case, Mr. Speaker, that no one, including those who have no problem with an extension, expected that this government would fail so miserably that an extension of any kind would be required. But it was always a possibility, Mr. Speaker. That is precisely why the EU Withdrawal Bill, at least in its original form, was drafted to provide for circumstances in which a withdrawal agreement came into force later than the 29th of March following an extension. As the government itself put it at the time in its delegated powers memorandum, and I quote, exit day will be dependent on the withdrawal negotiations with the EU. As my right honourable friend, the member for Wallasey, has already commented upon, it was the government's decision to play politics with the issue of exit day for the purposes of our domestic legislation, constraining the flexibility provided for in the original drafting of the bill by putting a fixed date and exit time on the face of it in a vain attempt to curry favour with the hardliners on their own benches. That means we require a statutory instrument in the form that is before us. That said, it remains the case that it is simply not reasonable to question the legitimacy of the government's actions in agreeing to an extension to the Article 50 process, or the fact that this regulation has sequentially followed that agreement.
I want to correct him on his account of recent history. In fact, the government agreed to put the date in voluntarily and then were blackmailed by the Remain faction in our party to add, put flexibility into the date. That's actually what happened.
I think he'd agree with me. The original draft of the bill did not include it. The reasons that the government put it in and the actions of the Right Honourable Gentleman, the member for West Dorset, and again, helpfully coming to the rescue, I leave to him and his view of what happened at the time. It follows, Mr Speaker, that if this House voted against this statutory instrument, it cannot prevent an extension of the Article 50 process taking place until at least one of the two proposed dates. In short, Mr Speaker, to force the UK out of the EU in 2 days' time, all that would be achieved by voting against this regulation would be immense legal confusion, with two parallel sets of regulations in place, those deriving specifically and directly from EU law and those made under the 2018 Act, which would diverge from it. As the Minister opposite put it, our statute book would be in a complete mess. And that is why, Mr Speaker, this statutory instrument should self-evidently be supported and why we will be doing so on this side of the House when we divide on it.
Thank you. Sir William Cash.
Thank you very much, Mr Speaker. The first point I'd like to raise is regarding the ministerial code and the actions of the Prime Minister. It is quite clear under the ministerial code, and I'm glad to see the Attorney-General is sitting here on the front bench, that the law officers must be consulted in good time before the government is committed to critical decisions involving legal considerations. Now, even if I was prepared to concede, which I'm not, that it follows that the law officers don't necessarily have to divulge their opinions, though actually he's been obliged to do so by a resolution of the House on the 4th of December in the past. The question is, as a matter of fact, which the Prime Minister today and 2 days ago has resolutely refused to answer me, did the Prime Minister consult the law officers as a matter of fact? I asked her and she refused twice time. The inference is that she did not. Is this not misleading the House? That is a question which worries me intensely. Mr Speaker, having dealt with that issue, which I regard as very serious, I also have to say that I take the strongest possible objection, as do many other distinguished lawyers, QCs and former judges, to the action that has been taken by the government in purporting to enter into a binding agreement in international law which purportedly alters the UK's exit date from the European Union in advance of the votes by each House on the draft regulations, which would create an alteration to exit day in the European Union Withdrawal Act 2018. It has been suggested, Mr Speaker, that the Act requires that the draft regulations can only be submitted to each House for an affirmative resolution once the date of exit has been altered at international level. This is simply not correct. The provision for approval by affirmative resolution is a freestanding provision in Schedule 7, paragraph 14, under which a draft instrument is to be submitted to the House. It was incumbent on the government, Mr Speaker, to respect the normal practice of allowing Parliament to approve any legislative changes before entering into a binding international obligation. Mr Speaker, I was the Shadow Attorney General during the Iraq debacle, and I have to say, Mr Speaker, that on that occasion it became apparent that there should have been consultation with Parliament on a matter of the gravest national importance. And the reality is, created the circumstances in which the then Attorney General submitted his opinion to the House. We had a similar situation with regard to the issue of the bombing of Syria more recently. So the idea that Parliament is not required to approve any legislative changes before entering into a binding international obligation is well established recently in precedent. The course taken seeks to present Parliament with a fait accompli in which Parliament is pressured to approve the draft regulations because failure to do so would cause disconformity, it is alleged by the Minister just now, between the UK's international obligations and domestic law. Under our constitutional law, Mr. Speaker, the power of the United Kingdom government to conclude binding agreements with states and other international actors, such as the European Union, exists under the royal prerogative. It is a basic principle of our constitutional law that the royal prerogative may only be exercised consistently with the intention of Parliament. Any purported exercise of that power, of the royal prerogative, that is inconsistent with the intention of Parliament, is unlawful and of no effect in our internal legal order. I am troubled, and this is why I asked for an intervention, as to what the outcome was of the Joint Committee on Statutory Instruments today, and I made the reference to the question of whether or not there was proper consideration of the question of whether or not it was intra vires or ultra vires. I do not know the answer to that question, but it's because I haven't been given the information. And I asked the Minister to check whether that was the case. Did they consider the question of vires in relation to the issues before that committee today? Now, the intention of Parliament, Mr. Speaker, is to be found solely in Acts of Parliament.